Okay, well, I have the 10:45, so I'll open in prayer. Abba Father, we thank you very much for this opportunity to come before you, to examine your word, consider what you have done, why you have done it. We ask you to inspire the speaking, open the ears, and help us all to learn more about you and your way. We thank you for these things and ask these in the name by the authority of your Son. Amen. It's my name is Everett Leisure, and we're talking about Torah changes in the wilderness of Sinai this time around. If there are notes on that first chair as you walk in the door, that will not probably not be complete everything I'm going to talk about, but hopefully it will help you a little bit. We all know that our Creator doesn't change. He is fundamentally the same. His personality, his mentality, his approach to things does not change. But in my studies, it has been apparent to me that there are changes that happened in the wilderness of Sinai. And I'm thinking, well, didn't he get it right the first time? Or is he fickle? He did get it right the first time. But the changes seem to revolve after what happened with the golden calf. He's not fickle, but it seems that he bent his will to accommodate Israel. Because of his love, respect for Moses and patriarchs, and for Israel as well. Now, we have the example of Yeshua, that it ought to be pretty plain what he expects. And I think he expects a higher standard than what he required of Israel. It's based on his original standard, what he did do right the first time, but there is much added instruction. And the added detail, the law added detail, but it also added some changes and some compromises. Most of them revolved around Levi and sacrifices. And specifically, in Exodus 19, we're told his intention of his original instruction and what he expected to have happen in Exodus 19 and verse 5. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people. For all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to Israel. Now the firstborn were a special designation among this group, but his intention was that the entire nation would represent him, each and every individual. But that didn't last for very long, because in Exodus 32, we have the account of the golden calf, which was about 40 days later. If you want the notes, there are notes on the first chair over there. Exodus 32, verse 10. Now therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them, and I will make of you a great nation. And he was going to do this because of what it says in verse 7. The Lord said to Moses, go get down, for your people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. They were no longer his people as far as the Creator was concerned. They were Moses' people, and he brought them out. Now, my workshop last year spent the entire time explaining the sequence of events that happened up until they were then reconfirmed as his people. I obviously don't have time to go through that all again. There's a booklet in the resource room, The Long-Term Effect of the Golden Calf, that you're welcome to if you go up there and get it. But I'll review a little bit, very briefly. In Deuteronomy 4, and verse 1, Deuteronomy is a covenant that was made just before they went into the Promised Land. Verse 1 says, "Now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and the judgments which I teach you to observe, that you may live and go in and possess the land which the Lord God of our fathers is giving you." This new covenant was an opportunity for them to wipe the slate clean and start over again. And its purpose was to allow them to live as opposed to being destroyed because of the golden calf. And Moses fell on his face for 40 days and 40 nights and pled for mercy. And Yahweh relented. And this was a new start. In verse 32 of Deuteronomy, verse 46, "And he said to them, set your hearts on all the words which I testify among you today, which you shall command your children to be careful to observe, all the words of this law." This law was what he commanded them that day. And in verse Deuteronomy 31, verse 24 says, "So it was when Moses had completing writing the words of this law in a book, when they were finished, that Moses commanded the Levites who bore the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, saying, take this book of the law and put it beside the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God, that it may be there as a witness against you." The original instruction was in the place of honor. Covenant of the Lord was the original instruction. This covenant was set beside the covenant of the Lord, outside the covenant.
Limited to the Levitical priesthood?
No. It was limited to the, at least the text, no more than the text of Deuteronomy, but that's another issue. But it was a different covenant. It was a covenant of the Lord in the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. And there was another one that was set outside. Deuteronomy 27 and verse 9. "Then Moses and the priests, the Levites, spoke to Israel, saying, take heed and listen, O Israel. This day you have become the people of the Lord your God." This day the slate was wiped clean and they started over fresh. But there were some changes. If we go back to Exodus 32, sorry, I should have told you to hold your place there. We see some of the fallout that occurred from the golden calf. And verse 26, "Then Moses stood in the entrance of the camp, and he said, whoever is on the Lord's side, let him come to me. And all the sons of Levi gathered themselves together." They volunteered to help out. And what they did is they went through Israel and they cleaned house. There were 3,000 killed. I presume that they were the ringleaders that had, you know, foisted or had promoted the calf. It doesn't really say that, but it just makes sense that they would take care of those who had caused the main share of the problem. And verse 29, "Then Moses said, consecrate yourselves today to the Lord, that he may bestow upon you a blessing this day, for every man has opposed his son and his brother." that Moses figured that, you know, you've done a good work here, and Yahweh is probably going to reward you. Well, the reward does come. It's explained in Numbers, chapter 3.
Excuse me, sir, what you meant?
Numbers 3?
Numbers 3?
Yeah. And verse 10 through 13. So you shall appoint Aaron and his sons, and they shall attend to their priesthood. But the outsider who comes near shall be put to death. Of course, that was anybody who wasn't a Levite. Whereas before, everyone was supposed to be a priest and represent him. Now, the Levites had that responsibility, and the rest of the nation was kept at arm's length. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Now behold, I myself have taken the Levites from among the children of Israel, instead of the firstborn who opens the womb among the children of Israel. Therefore, the Levites shall be mine, because all of the firstborn are mine. On the day that I struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, I sanctified to myself all the firstborn in Israel, both man and beast. So the firstborn had a special place as priesthoods, but he really wanted everybody to represent him and to be him. That was plan A, that the whole nation would represent him. Plan B was that Levite would do the job. Numbers 153 tells us a little bit more about the Levites and their responsibility. But the Levites shall camp around the tabernacle of the testimony, that there may be no wrath on the congregation of the children of Israel. And the Levites shall keep charge of the tabernacle of the testimony. Numbers 1:1, I believe, dates it to the first day of the second month of the year after they came out of Egypt. So it was the second year. So we have plan A, firstborn, and plan B, the Levites. Well, so which do we, you know, look to? Well, plan A never really designated a high priest, but Yeshua was the rock that followed them in the wilderness, and he was the one that acted on behalf of Yahweh in with Moses, and it seems to me that he was really the high priest in that particular case. In Hebrews 8, we have designated now who is expected to be the high priest. And in verse 1, now this is the main point of the things we are saying. We have such an high priest who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heavens, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle which the Lord erected, and not man. And of course, that's talking about Yeshua. He's the high priest at this particular point in time. 1 Peter touches on this as well. 1 Peter is specifically written to the pilgrims of the dispersion of Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. And in verse 5 of chapter 2, you also are living stones and being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. And in verse 9, you are a chosen priesthood, a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Yeah. Sounds to me it's a whole lot like plan A. that all of us represent our Creator. That there is not one group that does and one group that doesn't have to worry about it. Another thing that changed is the sacrificial plan or services, whatever. In Exodus 20, verse 24, it describes how to build an altar. It doesn't really tell you that you've got to use it. It doesn't tell you you have to do it. But it describes the construction of an altar. An altar of earth you shall make for me, and you shall sacrifice on it your burnt offerings, your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen. In every place where I record my name, I will come to you, and I will bless you. Well, Jeremiah 7 fills in some details of what happened after that. And it doesn't specifically link it with the golden calf, but I think you'll agree it likely applies. For I did not speak to your fathers or command them in the day that I brought them out of Egypt concerning burnt offerings or sacrifices. He told them how to build an altar. If they wanted out of gratitude to offer something, that was up to them. But this is what I commanded them, saying, obey my voice, and I will be your God, and you shall be my people, and walk in all the ways that I have commanded you, that it may be well with you. Yet they did not obey or incline their ear, but followed the counsels and dictates of their evil hearts, and they went backward and not forward. At that particular point in time, something needed to be done. He didn't talk to them about offerings at that time. The implication is obviously we need, the offerings came about as a result of this kind of activity. Well, certainly the golden calf qualifies for sliding backwards. But what the problem was that they followed the dictates of their own heart. Sin basically comes from the lust of the flesh. It's what we want. We want something that our Creator didn't intend we have or doesn't think we need at this particular point in time. It's just our will as opposed to what God's will is. And at that particular point in time, shortly after the golden calf, sacrifices were commanded. Leviticus 7 specifically mentions when that was. Now, Leviticus 1:1 claims to be spoken mainly from the tabernacle of meeting, which Moses set up outside the camp, far outside the camp, after the golden calf. And in verse 37, it says, this is the law of the burnt offering, the grain offering, the sin offering, the trespass offering, the consecrations, and the sacrifice of the peace offerings, which the Lord commanded on Mount Sinai, on the day when he commanded the children of Israel to offer their offerings to the Lord in the wilderness. Now, the easy thing to do is to connect that with Exodus 20, when Yahweh spoke the commandments from the mountain. But in fact, there were multiple occasions when Moses was on Mount Sinai, and specifically in Exodus 34, was the second 40-day stay on Mount Sinai, shortly after the episode of the golden calf, when he went up to get a second set of tablets. And in verse 29, start there in Exodus 34:29. Now it was so, when Moses came down from Mount Sinai, the two replacement tablets of the testimony were in Moses' hand when he came down from the mountain. And in verse 32, afterward, all the children of Israel came near, and he gave them as commandments all that the Lord had spoken with him on Mount Sinai. There are a number of places scattered throughout Leviticus and Numbers as well that talk about various instruction received on Mount Sinai. And they all use the exact same phrase that's used here in Exodus 34. And it is at this time when those sacrifices, offerings, were commanded of Israel after the golden calf. And what those sacrifices were intended to do is explained in Hebrews 10. Which does talk a fair amount about sacrifices and offerings. And verse 3.
Excuse me, sir. Could you speak up a little bit? The air conditioning or whatever it is.
It's kind of noisy.
It's very difficult to hear.
I'll do that. There are some seats up closer up front as well. My vocal system is not real strong. What can I say? No, that's fine. But in those sacrifices, Hebrews 10 verse 3, there is a reminder of sins every year. The intention of the awesome display that Yahweh did in Exodus 20 was to possibly put enough fear into them that they would not sin. It specifically says that in Exodus 20 verse 20. But they obviously did. Sacrifices were implemented as a reminder of those sins, to let them know that, you know, they had not lived up to the standard, and they were continually not living up in the standard. The sacrifices had to be done on a regular basis because they were continually falling short. What is the plan for us? Well, Romans 12, verse 1, which probably most of you are very familiar with. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. We're not to follow the dictates of our evil heart, as Israel did. But we are to sacrifice our will to Yeshua's will, to live according to his standard, not according to the way we think things ought to be done. And it takes careful examination of his word and thought to understand sometimes the difference. But that's why we've been given a mind, and we have a very patient creator who is working with us. But ultimately, we set our will aside, and that is our sacrifice, to do his will, unlike what the Israelites did. Another thing that was implemented, another change that was implemented, was in location of worship. We read the scripture where about the building of the altar, that he would come to us in every location. Well, the feast days are also, the hogs are included in the covenant at Sinai in Exodus 23. Starting in verse 14. So plan A is three times you shall keep a feast to me in the year. You shall keep the feast of unleavened bread. You shall eat unleavened bread 7 days, as I commanded you, at the time appointed in the month of Abib. For in it you came out of Egypt. None shall appear before me empty. And the feast of harvest, the first fruits of your labors, which you have sown in the field, and the feast of ingathering, which is in the end of the year, when you have gathered in the fruit of your labors from the field. Three times in the year all your males shall appear to me before the Lord your God. Basically, the only difference, it doesn't say the place. Because they could offer sacrifices in any place, he would come to them. They did not need to all go to a central location. But in Deuteronomy 12, beginning in verse 5, but you shall seek the place where the Lord your God chooses out of all your tribes to put his name for his dwelling place, and there you shall go. There you shall take your burnt offerings and your sacrifices, and the heave offerings of your hand, your vowed offerings, freewill offerings, and the first fruit of your herds and flocks. Verse 8. You shall not do at all as we are doing here today, every man doing what is right in his own eyes. Verse 10. But when you cross over the Jordan and dwell in the land which the Lord your God is giving you to inherit, and he gives you rest from all your enemies round about, so that you dwell in safety, then there will be the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide. There you shall bring all that I command you. Verse 13. Take heed to yourself that you do not offer burnt offerings in every place that you see, but in the place which the Lord chooses, in one of your tribes, there you shall offer burnt offerings. There you shall do all that I command you. Basically, they weren't to be trusted anymore to offer offerings. Obviously, after the golden calf, that makes a certain amount of sense. That they couldn't be trusted to do an offering on their own. They need to be supervised by somebody who was a little more knowledgeable, and evidently the Levites were a little more in tune to the mind of God. And so they were, you know, obviously put in charge. Deuteronomy 16:16 reinforces this. Because it talks about the feast, the three hogs again. Three times a year, all your males shall appear before the Lord your God in the place which he chooses, at the feast of unleavened bread, at the feast of weeks, and at the feast of tabernacles. And they shall not appear before the Lord empty. There again, it talks that it says they shall appear before the Lord at the place which he chooses. So they had to be under the supervision of the Levites in this. So, what is our responsibility in this, one way or another? Plan A or plan B? In John 4, verse 20, we have the account of Yeshua with the Samaritan woman at the well. And she asks Yeshua a question. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship. And Yeshua said to her, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. But you worship what you know not what. We know what we worship. Salvation is of the Jews. But the hour is coming, and now is, when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father is seeking such to worship Him. The geographical location is not important. If that were not true, this whole assembly would not be being blessed. But, and according to the law, we're in the wrong place. But there is no right place, because to a certain degree, Yeshua has made it impossible to follow the original the added instruction, the changed instruction. It was mentioned, firstborn. There was a change in the way the firstborn were handled. In Exodus 22, in verse 29, and there again it revolves again around the sacrifices. Verse 29, "You shall not delay to offer the first of your ripe produce and your juices, the firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. Likewise, you shall do with your oxen and your sheep. It shall be with its mother 7 days, and on the eighth day you shall give it to me." Since they were allowed to build their own altar, they could gather 12 stones together or build an altar of earth, and on the eighth day they could offer the firstborn to Yahweh. Well, in Deuteronomy, in the law that was added and set next to the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, Deuteronomy 15 and verse 19. "All the firstborn males that come from your herd and your flock you shall sanctify to the Lord your God. You shall do no work with the firstborn of your herd, nor shear the firstborn of your flock. And you and your household shall eat it before the Lord your God, year by year, in the place which the Lord chooses." Now, I'm a city boy. I'm not a farmer, or a rancher, but I can't see anybody shearing an 8-day-old sheep, nor working with an 8-day-old ox. That they were allowed to keep them for an extended period of time until they went up to the place. A few verses after what we read in chapter 15, in the beginning of chapter 16, to observe the month of Abib and keep the Passover to the Lord your God. So likely there's a bit of a connection there, that when they went up to the festivals, they took their firstborn. As long as they hadn't worked them or, sheared them, they were to take them up there and to offer them basically as a peace offering. That when they went to the festivals, I suppose if they wanted to go up at some other time, they could do it. But for anybody with any kind of a herd at all, it would be a logistical nightmare to travel any distance to Jerusalem to offer the firstborn on the eighth day. You'd be traveling back and forth and maybe be in the middle of a trip when it was time to go get another one, it would be quite a mess. So what do we do now? Well, we can still redeem our sons and our daughters. Exodus 13 allows that we redeem our sons and daughters and unclean animals. We can still do that. today, and actually we could still offer, build an altar of stones or earth, a rancher, and offer the firstborn on the eighth day. Now, there may be legal ramifications to that. You know, I don't know. Check with your local authorities, I guess. But there was no allowance to redeem the firstborn. And they have to be taken to the place. Well, there is no the place. So you really can't do it according to the instruction that Moses added and set next to the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. I'm going to skip over to the Passover. In the notes I handed out, I deal with circumcision. I'm not sure I'm going to have time. I might have time to deal with that, but want to go to the Passover section and talk about the Passover. Passover, as it turns out, is not mentioned at Sinai. Unleavened bread is mentioned at Sinai, but the Passover is not specifically included in the covenant at Sinai. Obviously, it was intended to be kept. There's little doubt about that. But Exodus 12 is the main chapter that describes the Passover. The lamb shall be without blemish, verse 5, a male of the first year. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. Now you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation shall kill it at twilight. And they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses where they eat it. And they shall eat the flesh on that night, roasted in fire, and unleavened bread, with bitter herbs they shall eat it. Do not eat it raw or boiled at all with water, but roasted in fire, its head and its legs and entrails. Numbers 19 talks about the first occasion of Passover after they went, after they started wandering in the wilderness. Numbers 9 and verse 1. Now the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the first month of the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, "Let the children of Israel keep the Passover at its appointed time. On the 14th day of the month, at twilight, you shall keep it at its appointed time. According to all its rites and ceremonies, you shall keep it." Well, the only rites and ceremonies that had been designated at that time were those of Exodus 12. But the temple did exist at that time, and they could have done it that way. But it was a very new. Levi had just been anointed, or Aaron had, and his sons had just been anointed. And the covenant that allowed a change had not been confirmed yet, was not confirmed until Deuteronomy. Anyway, they kept it, it appears, according to Exodus 12. Now, they didn't have houses, but they had tents, which had posts probably to hold up the door. So there doesn't seem to be any change at this particular point in time. But in Deuteronomy 12, the instructions are significantly different. Originally, of course, the sacrifice was to be a yearling sheep or goat. In Deuteronomy 16, verse 2, The instruction reads that it's to come from the herd or the flock. I get the right chapter here. Therefore, you shall sacrifice the Passover to the Lord your God from the flock and the herd in the place where the Lord chooses to put his name. Well, the word for herd is bakur, or something to that effect. Pardon my Hebrew, those of you who know it. It specifically means a bovine animal. The goats ran with the flock, not the herd. So he's including, he's allowing not only the sheep or goat, but also a cattle. And in 2 Corinthians 35, at Josiah's Passover, it specifically mentions them bringing cattle for the Passover and cooking cattle at the same time as the Passover, as the lambs, and serving them to all the people. Now, it was originally the sacrifice was offered and eaten at someone's home. Deuteronomy 16, 5 and 6 instructs that it not be eaten anywhere but the place where the presence of God was. Verse 5, you may not sacrifice the Passover with any of your gates, which the Lord your God gives you, but at the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide, there you shall sacrifice the Passover, at twilight, at the going down of the sun, at the time you came out of Egypt. Now actually, the Hebrew word behind twilight there is Arab, which is evening. It's a more general expression than is used in Exodus 12 and in Numbers 9. Literally, Exodus 12 and 9 say between the evenings, which is an idiom for twilight, just like twilight sort of means two evenings, you know, or two lights. It means the same thing. Here, my translation says twilight, but that's not what the Hebrew is underneath. It's changed. It's Arab. It's just evening, which is more a general expression that can actually start in late afternoon and go into evening. And you'll notice here it says, but at the place where the Lord your God chooses to make his name abide, you shall sacrifice the Passover. At twilight, at the going out of the down of the sun, at the time you came out of Egypt. Why doesn't it say, well, at the time you killed the Passover the first time? Because the time is changing, and they got out of Egypt as the sun was going down, whereas twilight really doesn't start until the sun goes down. And there's a little bit of a difference there.
So you're saying they left before the sun went down?
They left Egypt while the sun was on its... Yeah. Got out on the 15th of the month. Yeah. Originally, the sacrifice was to be roasted with fire. Boiling was specifically prohibited in Exodus 12, verse 8 and 9. Deuteronomy 16:7 uses the same Hebrew word for boil, bashal, in Exodus 12, but it's specifically how they should cook the Passover. It was not a prohibition. Verse 7 of Deuteronomy 16. My translation says, you shall roast and eat it, but the word there is specifically is boil. Generally, it means cook. It tends to mean boil, but it applies to all methods of cooking as well. And in it, like it did with twilight and evening, the translators are trying to make these two accounts fit together, but they don't fit. but they don't understand that there's a change taking place here. And so they're trying to make the accounts fit, so they translate boil as roast, because that's what the original instruction was. Everybody knows that. They were supposed to roast it. So that's what it must mean here.
Did you say that was without the entrails as well, or?
Well, what does it say? And you shall roast, boil or cook and eat it in the place which the Lord your God chooses. It doesn't really say. I can't think of any.
The way they were cooking it, maybe it might change the preparation of cooking too.
Yeah. Maybe I suspect that since he. It seems to me that the whole logistics of keeping the Passover in a single group would be totally different than doing it at home with a group in a family kind of atmosphere. And what he's trying to do is make it work somehow or another. He's bending his rules because of his love for Moshe and the patriarchs and Israel to allow them to live, you know, a minimum kind of compliance and go into the promised land. And so if he's not worried about it being roasted as opposed to being cooked, whatever way works, he's probably not worried about all the parts being in any particular place at the same time. Let's see. So, what do we do for the Passover? Do we do it according to the original instruction, or according to how Israel, or the law that was set beside the covenant of the Lord? Well, 1 Corinthians 5, verse 7. I'm sure most of you are familiar with as well, touches on this. 1 Corinthians 5:7. Therefore, purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, since you are truly unleavened. For indeed, Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. The original meaning of Pesach was evidently protection, if you go back far enough. That's what the Passover provided Israel on the night that he killed the firstborn, is protection. Well, we obviously can't go to the place. We can't keep it exactly the way the law Moses wrote requires of it. We could keep it according to the original instruction. But Yeshua is our Passover. Let me remind you that the original, the covenant in Exodus 20 doesn't specifically mention anything about the Passover. Now, did Abraham keep the Passover? Well, Abraham's covenant was confirmed on that same night, but it wasn't really the Passover. It was the confirmation of his covenant. His covenant was really identical to the covenant that was made in Exodus 20. 1 Chronicles 16, 15 through 18 basically says he remembered his covenant, covenant he made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and confirmed it to Israel as well. That was all the same covenant. But it doesn't specifically mention Passover. The Corinthians, let me back up. Of course, Yeshua got together with his disciples and confirmed a new celebration, the bread and the wine, a memorial of his death, and a memorial of the new covenant as well. It is connected very closely with the Passover, very tightly with the Passover. And it's being observed by the Corinthian church in 1 Corinthians 11. At least the timing was very closely connected with the Passover. He obviously died as the Passover lamb. You observe a memorial, you do it when somebody dies, you know, usually. Okay. In 1 Corinthians 11, it talks about the Corinthian church keep doing that memorial. And verse 23, "For I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you, that Yeshua, on the same night in which he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, 'Take, eat, this is my body, which is broken for you. This do in remembrance of me.' In the same manner, he also took the cup after supper, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood. This do as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death till he comes. Therefore, whoever eats this bread and drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. But he, let a man examine himself, so let him eat of the bread, drink of this cup. For he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment to himself, not discerning the Lord's body." Verse 33. "Therefore, my brethren, when you come together to eat, wait for one another. But if anyone is hungry, let him eat at home, lest you come together for judgment, and the rest I will set in order when I come." There's no mention of the Passover in this particular occasion, but the day is tied to the Passover. Christ is our Passover. Was it insufficient? Is his sacrifice insufficient to provide us the protection we need? I don't think so. So there's nothing specifically mentioned in the original instruction about the Passover, but it does say to keep the days of unleavened bread. 1 Corinthians 5 said, "Christ your Passover is sacrificed for you. Keep the days, you know, keep the feast of unleavened bread." Abraham probably didn't keep the Passover. Maybe a memorial of his covenant, and it makes is certainly, since his covenant would have included unleavened bread, Feast of Weeks, and tabernacles, he probably observed that whole week, but he did it slightly differently than what Israel did throughout their history and in the Promised Land. And it appears that yet again that has changed. And we look forward as well to the marriage supper in the kingdom of God that will probably happen again on that same evening. The law that Moses wrote and set next to the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord is a good law. But the original, Yeshua is taking us back to the original instruction. Yahweh did it right the first time. The law that Moses wrote adds a lot of detail to that, and we need that detail. But some of that instruction was specifically for Israel in the Promised Land. It was not his intention. He wanted everybody to represent him. And he wants us all to represent him. He wants us to set aside our own way and do his way based on the original instruction. And we can't read that instruction. You can't read those three chapters, especially Exodus 20 through halfway through 23. You can't read that like you read any other place. You can't gloss over it. There is some really deep stuff in there that you have to understand, that this is solid. This is locked in concrete. This does not change. This is not subject to, well, am I close enough to go? You know, well, you know, how do I handle this because this can't apply? He expects us to examine that instruction and walk in his way, to sacrifice our will to do what he wants, what he originally asked of us. Are there any questions?